Okay, so let's turn to the Gospel of Mark. And what I'm going to argue tonight is that the Gospel of Mark was written by a disciple of the Apostle Peter sometime in the 60s AD to encourage a persecuted group of Christians in Italy, most likely Rome. You'll remember, in contrast to the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew was written primarily for a Jewish Christian audience, and Matthew being the tax collector, but he had a lot of Jewish points that he was trying to make, quoted a lot of Jewish scripture, a lot from the Old Testament. He was talk about Jewish things and not give any kind of explanation for Gentile hearers. He would just assume that people understood the Jewish context and Jewish traditions. Mark is not that way. And Mark is primarily written for Gentiles, not for Jewish people. It's a very important difference between those two Gospels. The tradition of the church holds that Mark was the writer of the second Gospel. The Gospel doesn't name an author within it, but the earliest testimonies of the church fathers attribute the authorship to Mark. And whenever the Gospel was copied, it would also have a title in the front, according to Mark. Mark was a ministry companion of the apostles, especially the Apostle Paul and the Apostle Peter. He was a disciple and an assistant to the Apostle Peter, especially. Some of the earliest Christian writers indicate that Mark is the one that wrote it. A good example is the church father named Papias. He was the bishop in Asia Minor around AD 130. There aren't any existing copies of Papias's writings. He wrote a very large book that is no longer with us. But what we do have are later authors who quote him. So that's how we know some of the things that Papias wrote. And one of the examples of a later author who quotes Bishop Papias is the historian Eusebius, who wrote around AD 325. And in his work, Church History or Ecclesiastical History, Book 3, Chapter 39, Section 15, he quotes Papias as saying this: "Mark, having become the interpreter of Peter, wrote down accurately, though not in order, whatsoever he remembered of the things said or done by Christ. For he neither heard the Lord nor followed him, but afterward, as I said, he followed Peter, who adapted his teaching to the needs of his hearers." So what Papias is saying is that Mark, first of all, was the interpreter of Peter. Now, what we take that term, and most scholars understand that to mean that he was Peter's translator. Peter, being a Galilean fisherman, would have spoken Aramaic, but he became a missionary that went into around the region of the Mediterranean, and as the tradition of the church has it, he was the bishop of Rome, the first bishop of the church in Rome. Well, when speaking to the Roman Christians and the people of Rome, if he spoke Aramaic, that certainly would not have been the language that they spoke. They would have spoken Latin or known Greek. And so Peter always needed a translator when speaking to Greek-speaking people or Latin speakers. So Mark, Bishop Papias says, it was Peter's interpreter. As someone who's done mission work in a foreign country, I've gone to the country of Honduras, where I don't speak Spanish, un poco, very little. An interpreter is an invaluable thing. And one of the things about interpreters is you have to have a very good, trustworthy relationship with an interpreter, because you're going to be conveying the gospel, and you want to convey that in a way that the people that hear it can understand. And say you're passionate and you're preaching the sense of the message, and then you look over at your interpreter and they're in a monotone, wooden kind of way, not conveying it. And you can see that the people out in the audience are not getting it. And so an interpreter must be able to convey both the content and the emotion and style and put it into a content and an appropriate cultural style that the audience can hear. And so Peter obviously had confidence in Mark to do that for him and to be that sort of right-hand person as he was doing that mission work in the city of Rome. Now, notice also here that Bishop Papias says that Mark wrote down accurately, though not in order, whatsoever he remembered of the things said or done by Christ. And there was probably some dispute that the chronology was wrong that Mark was offering in the events. We haven't done the Gospel of John yet, but the Gospel of John has a different chronology to the teachings and ministry of Jesus than Mark does and the other two synoptic Gospels. And one of the most memorable differences in the chronology is right at the beginning of the Gospel of John, Jesus goes in and clears the temple. And you'll know that that comes later in the synoptic Gospels. And so this may have been a critique of those who really were disciples of John or followers of the Johannine Gospel, that they were critiquing Mark for, in a sense, getting it wrong. Who knows, but that's what some believe. We also learn here that Mark was not one who was at the time following the Lord directly and hearing these teachings, but he was delivering what Peter said, Jesus said. As an interpreter of Peter, if he was Peter's right-hand person, he would have had an intimate knowledge of the content of Peter's stories and the content of Peter's experience with Jesus. He would have had to have really gotten that message down if he was going to be the translator of Peter's sermons. And he would have basically gotten to the point where he could have just preached these things without having Peter actually there. There are two other sources in the early church that also affirm that Mark wrote the gospel, and I'll give you just the references to them. The Anti-Marcionite prologue to the second gospel, which was written around AD 170, that asserts Mark's authorship. The church father Irenaeus, also around AD 177, also affirmed this view. And in addition to this, the earliest Greek manuscripts give the title of the book according to Mark. So to dispute that Mark was the one that wrote this, which some New Testament scholars do, is just a reach and a stretch. But nevertheless, people assert all kinds of stuff. And you can find scholars that will say that Mark didn't write it. We first hear of Mark in Acts chapter 12, verse 12. And why don't you take a look at that story there so you can get to know this guy a little bit. Now, the context is Peter is bound in chains with some soldiers in prison. And in the night, an angel of the Lord comes and wakes Peter up and liberates him from the cell. And so Peter has been dramatically freed from prison by an angel of God. And the place that he goes to in Jerusalem is the house of Mary. This is verse 12 of chapter 12. The house of Mary, the mother of John, whose other name was Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying. So the context is, you know, Peter's been imprisoned for his preaching in Jerusalem, and there's a group of Christians that are in this house of Mary praying for him and praying for what has happened. And it's in that context of prayer that Peter shows up. Hey, you aren't going to believe this. An angel of the Lord sprung me. And so John is there as John Mark. He's called John. He's also, but the Acts tells us it's Mark. Now, Acts is written by Luke, who is also one of the missionary companions of Paul and Peter. And so Luke is recounting this story and gives us that information that his name was John, also named Mark. And so they're gathered there praying, and Peter, when he knocks at the door of the gateway, a servant girl named Rhoda comes to answer. Recognizing Peter's voice in her joy, she did not open the gate but ran in and reported that Peter was standing at the gate. So she didn't even open it up for him. She just couldn't contain herself. He's out there knocking on the door. Well, go let him in. Are you out of your mind? But she kept insisting it was so, and they kept saying, it's his angel. But Peter continued knocking, and when they opened, they saw him and were amazed. But motioning to them with his hand to be silent, he described to them how the Lord had brought him out of the prison. And he said, tell these things to James and to the brothers. And then he departed and went to another place. So one could just, if say Mark is a young boy, maybe, or a teenager, he's probably an adolescent. And this is his introduction to the Apostle Peter. And the power of God as well. And I am sure that at that moment he said, I want in. You know, I want to be a part of that. And that's exactly what we find happening as the story progresses. You get to chapter 12, verse 25. Chapter 12, verse 25. And Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem when they had completed their service, bringing with them John, whose other name was Mark. So Mark joins the apostolic band and the missionary journeys and embarks with Paul and Barnabas on their first missionary journey to the Mediterranean. Now what ends up happening is, as Mark is there assisting Paul and Barnabas, and we learn from, I think it's Colossians, that Barnabas is actually John Mark's cousin. Okay, so this is probably his younger cousin that he's bringing along because he's all excited about what's happening and he's really wanting to be a part. But when they get out there in the field, they begin to encounter some opposition, and Mark deserts and he leaves and goes back to Jerusalem. And this actually becomes an issue for Paul and Barnabas. Because a little bit later on, Mark wants back in. And Paul says, no. No, he was not with us when we went through it. And I don't know if, you know, Paul was being mean about it or just, you know, he's young. He's not up for the persecution and the challenge. You know, let's not do that. We've been there, done that. We know what he's going to do when the going gets tough. But for some reason, Paul said no. And Barnabas insisted. And so this became the parting of the ways of Paul and Barnabas, was over the issue of whether to include Mark. And this whole story is actually told in Acts chapter 15. So let's just look at that real quick. Acts chapter 15, verse 36. After some days, Paul said to Barnabas, let us return and visit the brothers in every city where we proclaim the word of the Lord and see how they are. Now Barnabas wanted to take with them John, called Mark. But Paul thought best not to take with them one who had withdrawn from them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to the work. And there arose a sharp disagreement, so that they separated from each other. Barnabas took Mark with him, and they sailed away to Cyprus. But Paul chose Silas and departed, having been commended by the brothers to the grace of the Lord. And he went through Syria and Cilicia, strengthening the churches. So this is the place where Paul and Barnabas part ways over a disagreement on what to do. And then it's Paul and Silas at that point. Silas is also known as Silvanus in the New Testament. And it's an interesting thing. First Peter, which is also attributed to the Apostle Peter, Peter did not write First Peter directly, but he had to use help. And at the end of First Peter, you'll see how Peter uses assistance to get Greek letters written. Look at 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 12. 1 Peter 5, verse 12 says this, "By Silvanus, a faithful brother as I regard him, I have written briefly to you, exhorting and declaring that this is the true grace of God. Stand firm in it." So the letter is from Peter, but Peter acknowledges that he's writing the letter through Silvanus or Silas. So this is the letter, or Silas is the same guy that went with Paul on the missionary journey when they parted ways with Barnabas. But notice here that he keeps going, "She who is at Babylon, who is likewise chosen, sends you greetings." Now, Babylon was code language for Rome. Okay? And the good example of that is the book of Revelation, where the city of Rome is, and the Roman Empire is called Babylon. But early Christians referred to Rome as Babylon. So here Peter is working as the bishop of Rome, and he's writing this letter from Rome. He's using an assistant translator, Silas, and he also then says, "She who is in Babylon," that would be the church of Rome, "who is likewise chosen, sends you greetings, and so does Mark my son." So there's Mark again, also there as a son or a disciple of Peter. Okay? So one gets the impression from all of this that Mark and Silas are people who are assisting these apostles in their ministry, helping them to do the work that they're trying to do, acting as interpreters and translators and scribes, writing letters for them, serving as their secretaries for their correspondence. You see that? You see it? And so this is what Mark's role is. He's like Silas in that way. And I think Luke functioned in this way as well. He was he's often referenced at the end of these letters. Luke says hi. Luke sends greetings along with Demas and Mark and Silas. And they name all of these different assistants and people that were part of the entourage that helped accomplish the mission as they're going around on these apostolic journeys. And Mark is playing a key role. Now, so Peter calls Mark his son. Also, at some point later, it becomes evident that Mark regains the confidence of the Apostle Paul. He ministers to him while he was in prison. Paul mentions that in the book of Colossians. He says of Mark that he was a comfort to me and one of the few people of the circumcision that stuck with him. So he was helpful to him in prison. In 2 Timothy, Paul encourages Timothy to go and fetch Mark. Bring him to him because he's very useful for ministry. So again, Mark is seen as this assistant role, this helpful guy for the ministry of Paul. And in another letter, he calls him a fellow worker, Paul's letter to Philemon. So that's something of the story of Mark that you can get from the New Testament and also from some of the early church fathers. And we'll see some of the other quotes that reference what Mark was doing and what how this happened. The bishops of the early church, and I want to shift gears a little bit. And so on the one hand, we looked at who the author is. Now we want to look at who the audience that the gospel has been written to. And what do we learn about them? And what can we know about them? Again, I said Matthew was predominantly written to a Jewish audience. Mark was, I'm going to argue, was written to a Gentile Roman audience. The bishops of the early church, Papias, Clement, Irenaeus, all taught that Mark wrote his gospel from Italy, and some identified specifically Rome. Irenaeus, who was around 130 to 200, said that the gospel of Mark was written when Peter and Paul were preaching the gospel in Rome and founded the church there. And he adds, after their departure, Mark, Peter's disciple, has himself delivered to us in writing the substance of Peter's preaching. Okay? So the idea here is that Peter is preaching these sermons, and Mark is delivering the content of what Peter is preaching in his writing. And people could ask Mark, can you give me a copy of what Peter's sermons are? You know, can you tell me what? And Mark would give them a copy of the outline of Peter's message. You see? And so in the first letter of the book of Peter, I already read this to you, Mark is identified as a disciple of Peter in Rome. She who is at Babylon, who is likewise chosen, sends you greetings, and so does Mark, my son. Babylon being code language for the city of Rome, so it's likely that the gospel was written by Mark from Rome for Italian Christians. And we have this confirmed by many of the internal features from Mark's gospel. The gospel often explains Jewish customs to its readers. For example, in Mark chapter 7, verse 3 to 4, why don't you take a look at that passage? Mark chapter 7. And I'm just going to start from verse 1. Now when the Pharisees gathered to him with some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem, they saw that some of his disciples ate with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. And then he puts a parenthetical comment here. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands, holding to the tradition of the elders. And when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other traditions that they observe, such as the washing of cups and pots and copper vessels and dining couches. And then he keeps going on with the story. So why would he add that parenthetical comment? Well, obviously, because he's writing to people that wouldn't know the customs of Jewish people. Why would they be so focused on all this washing? Well, because they took defilement and clean and unclean very seriously, and he explains that in a very brief way to the audience that he's writing to. And he does that in several other places, and I gave you the references there, chapter 14 and 15. He also explains some of the other customs. You also know that his audience is largely a Gentile audience, because he often translates Aramaic terms to the Greek. An example, since we're in chapter 7, we'll look at chapter 7, verse 11. But you say, if a man tells his father or mother, whatever you would have gained from me is korban, and then he translates it, that is, given to God. So korban would be the Aramaic phrase. He knows that his readers don't know Aramaic, so he gives them a Greek interpretation, okay? And he does that with a lot of Aramaic terms, and you have the references there. He'll point out geographic details that would not be known to a non-Jewish audience, such as he was sitting on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple. You wouldn't have had to tell a Jewish person where the Mount of Olives was in relationship to the temple. But Mark does, because he knows his readers wouldn't know that it was right across from the temple. He also, and what all of those points make is that this is a Gentile readership. It doesn't locate the gospel in Italy. But what comes next would. Mark uses a lot of times what are known as transliterations of Greek of Latin words. So he's using Latin words with Greek letters. It's basically the idea. And he often does this. He does it at least 15 times, which indicates a large portion of his audience understood Latin. Well, Latin was only really spoken in Italy. Okay? Was not primarily spoken outside of Italy at the time. And so Mark 4:27, there's an example. Modius is the Latin modius, a measure. Legion, spectacular, or speculator, denarius. There's a bunch of Latin words. And he's putting them into Greek letters, but he's using the Latin word. Now, so the internal indirect evidence for Roman readership is the fact that in his passion narrative, Mark unnecessarily, from a literary point of view, identifies Alexander and Rufus as the sons of Simon. Now, this is the people that are sons of the man who picked up Jesus' cross when it fell. Alexander and Rufus are probably people that were known to the Roman church. These men were mentioned because one of them, Rufus, is mentioned in the book of Romans by Paul in Romans chapter 16, verse 13. So why would Mark mention these people if he didn't know that, I'm just going to throw this name in here because here's one of the people that is right here in your church. And you'll recognize Rufus, right? We got Rufus with us still. And so he just throws that little bit of information in there. So all of these kinds of things are this type, and there's other things that you could point to. I didn't list them all, but these are the kinds of things that that make scholars think and believe that Mark was disciple of Peter, preaching from the Roman church, ministering to Roman Christians. Okay? Part of the thing about when you're doing interpretations of Scripture, it's important to understand the original context to which it was written. When you're looking at a book of the Bible, because if you just take a passage from the Scriptures and you directly apply it to you as if it was just written for you, you're going to make a lot of mistakes in interpretation and application. An example would be, we're reading right now in the Bible Challenge from the book of Leviticus, and there's tremendous detail there about how to make sacrifices of bulls and goats and what to do with their entrails and all of this sort of thing and how to do burnt offerings correctly and that sort of thing, right? And you might go, well, are we supposed to do this? I mean, these things are all commanded by God. Well, if you were to do those sacrifices now exactly in those ways, you would actually be sinning. Now, the people that first received that book, if they didn't do the sacrifices exactly that way, they would be sinning. Okay? And in fact, the great example of that is in Leviticus when Aaron is ordained and his sons are ordained to be the priests to do all those sacrifices. And the two of his sons go and offer some kind of inappropriate fire on the altar of God and they're instantly consumed. Why? Because God really was concerned about all those details. And you're not at the liberty, if you're the priests of Aaron, to tinker with the instructions of God and how you're to approach a holy, holy, holy God as a sinful people. But it would be wrong for us to take the book of Leviticus and directly apply it to our lives. Why? Because a lot's happened contextually in redemptive history since then. Jesus has died on the cross, and so now the blood and bulls and goats are no longer relevant. In fact, they're completely inappropriate. The temple has been destroyed, and with good reason, because Jesus is the final high priest and the final sacrifice for sins. And so it's inappropriate historically and contextually to apply much of Leviticus directly to us. Does that mean, though, that Leviticus doesn't have a teaching or a meaning for us? Of course not. It's got an interpretive meaning to us, an application to us that we should take away, that God seriously takes seriously sin, and that you cannot have forgiveness of sin without atonement and some type of blood payment for sin. And Paul would argue in the book of Romans that Jesus' blood sacrifice on the cross is the only atonement for the sins of the people of the world. And so that's how we need to interpret the book of Leviticus through the grid of the New Testament and through the theology of the New Testament and understanding what Jesus has done. Well, the same thing is true of these Old Testament books of the Bible. Of the New Testament books of the Bible. If we understand the context to which this book is written, then we will also understand its emphases and what it's trying to get across. And we go to apply the book of Mark, for example, to our lives, understanding who it was originally written to, we can better make direct application to our lives in the context of what we're going through now. Okay, so let's think about what the context was of the first audience of the Gospel of Mark and what they were wrestling with and how the book might apply. So the primary reason for the gospel was to capture the preaching and teaching of the Apostle Peter prior to his death. The early Christians knew that they would not have the apostles with them in person for much longer. Peter, James, or Peter and James and John were dying or in prison. Paul wasn't going to live forever. They were passing away. You had the same type of issue when Moses was dying. How are we going to know what we're supposed to do and what we're supposed to follow, and how are we going to remember all these stories and these teachings and what happened? How will we remember these things? You write them down, right? Write them down. And so people began to ask, people like Mark, let's get these things recorded. Let's get this stuff written down. And so here's an example of the history of that. Clement of Alexandria, who's one of the bishops, in his writing says that the Christians in Rome asked Mark to record Peter's message. When Peter had preached the gospel publicly in Rome, those who were present besought Mark, since he had followed him, Peter, for a long time, and remembered the things that had been spoken, to write out the things that had been said. And when he had done this, he gave the gospel to those who asked him. When Peter learned of it later, he neither obstructed nor commended. Okay? So you see that Clement's recollection of how the origins of Mark took place is people began to ask, can you get what Peter said written down for us? We'd like a copy of that. And then what it says is lots of people started asking him for those copies, and he would record that and give them the copies. Okay? The Bishop of Clement says that Peter neither obstructed nor commended Mark's writings, but it's quite possible that Mark was commissioned by the Apostle Peter himself to write the gospel. In 2 Peter chapter 1, we read this: I think it's right, as long as I'm in this body, to stir you up by way of reminder, since I know that the putting off of my own body will be soon, as our Lord Jesus Christ has made clear to me. And I will make every effort so that after my departure, the Greek word there is actually exodus, which I think is kind of cool, that after my exodus, you may be able to at any time to recall these things. Now, how would Peter make sure that after his departure, they would always be able to remember these things? Write it down, right? Have a gospel written. And so that is likely, and this is actually Charlie Holt's theory on 2 Peter and what he's saying here. I haven't ever read any other scholar use this verse in this way, but I believe that that Peter was indicating to the readers of his second letter that I know I'm about to die, and I need to make sure that you'll be able to remember the things that the apostles have said, that I and the other apostles have said. And so I'm going to make sure that that happens. And part of his investment in the person of Mark as his son in the faith was to really convey through Mark the experiences he had, his understanding of the teachings of Jesus, and get that recorded for future generations. It's the issue of apostolic succession. There's a doctrine of the church called apostolic succession, and we're about to kind of go through that a little bit with the retirement of the Pope. And what Romans mean by apostolic succession is that somebody to follow physically in the line of the Apostle Peter. But I think what Peter was concerned about in terms of succession is not so much that there would be a physical laying on of hands of a person, though I do think that was important to him. But what was also and equally important, at least, was that there would be a succession of teaching, and that the teaching would be passed on from generation to generation accurately. And I believe Peter ensured that that would happen. It was a sacred trust that was given to him. And the warrant for that is in the Jewish heritage itself. Moses made sure that the Mosaic law and Mosaic teaching was passed on for future generations, and that there was a succession there. And the succession was not just in the teaching of Moses and the passing on of the Torah and the laws and the recounting of the history, but was also in the rituals that were put into place. And we had an example of that when we most recently heard from Deuteronomy on Sunday, where the Israelites were instructed that when they paid their tithes, they were to say some words. They'd pay their basket of tithes of their grain, and then they would say, "My parents were wandering Arameans, and we sold ourselves into slavery into Egypt, and God, by a mighty hand, rescued us from Pharaoh's bondage with plagues and led us through the wilderness and brought us to the promised land of milk and honey." Now, why would that ritual be put there in the life of the Israelites? So they would preserve an understanding of who they were, and they would remember the story by recounting it over and over and over again, and never forget the teaching. I think the apostles did the same things with Jesus' teachings and Jesus' words. They were good Jews. They had been trained how to do that with Jewish stories, that you would learn these things orally and recount them over and over again. Every time you gave a tithe, you would tell the story of the rescue of Abraham and the rescue of the Israelites out of Egypt. Well, I think they had done the same thing with the gospel narrative. And Mark probably just had it cold. You know, he probably could stand up and recite the entire gospel of Mark, because he had been trained by Peter to do that. So I think Peter likely commissioned the writing of the gospel, and that's what he's conveying there in 2 Peter, that he's going to make every effort that after my exodus you will be able to recall these things. And I already mentioned about how Peter's first letter, he used Silvanus as a translator. Bishop Papias, we already learned that Mark served in a similar capacity in Rome. I actually think Mark was probably the one who served as the translator for 2 Peter. A second reason for the gospel writing is to encourage the Gentile Christians who were undergoing persecution during the reign of the Roman Emperor Nero. Mark's gospel emphasizes the crucifixion of Jesus. In fact, the story of the events leading up to the crucifixion comprise half of Mark's gospel, whereas it's a lot less as a percentage in the other two synoptic gospels. Mark certainly wanted the readers to know what it meant to take up their cross and follow Jesus. And the context for Christians in Rome, I have a quote from one of our Anglican scholars here. The 60s AD in Rome was really a tough time for Christians. You've got to remember that up until that time in Roman law, if you were Jewish, you were part of a recognized religion. It was known as religio licita, a permitted religion. And so there was not much persecution coming to Jewish Christians because the Romans are thinking, well, they're just part of Judaism, just a Jewish sect. But what happens when Roman authorities begin to sense, ah, this new religion seems to be including Gentiles, non-Jews, and is rather different to Judaism? Suddenly, it's no longer a safe or permitted religion. And the Roman authorities might get rather uptight about that. And I would add to what Dr. Walker is saying that you'll remember that that Paul was imprisoned by these Roman soldiers, and he mentions in some of his letters how the Roman guard was becoming Christian. And I actually believe that this is how Christianity spread to where it eventually overtook the Roman Empire, is that I think the seed of that started with Paul's conversion of Roman soldiers in the Roman guard and began to spread up the line of the Roman hierarchy and the Roman ranks. And those Roman soldiers probably were some of the strong Christian advocates that led to Emperor Constantine declaring that the Roman army would fly under the banner of Christ. So that's another theory of Charlie Holt that may or may not be worth anything.
Well, probably some history can bear it out if somebody really did a history.
Yeah.
Really studied that.
But Nero saw the Christians as a threat. And so there was a lot of persecution of Christian people. Now so suddenly it's no longer safe to or permitted religion. The Roman authorities might get rather uptight about that. Now that's precisely what begins to happen or being recognized in Rome in the early years of 60 AD. In the year 59, Nero goes slightly mad, and the first 5 years of his reign are rather good, but from then on, until he dies in 68, he's becoming more and more unpredictable. Then you've got Paul arriving in Rome in about AD 60, and he's willing to die for Christ and willing to show that this newfound religion is for everybody, including the Emperor Nero. And it's possible that as Nero encounters this, he begins to realize, here's a religion which I don't like. I'm meant to be in charge, and here are these Christians proclaiming Jesus is Lord. Kurios, which was the Greek title that Caesar used for himself. So when there's a great fire in Rome on July the 18th in AD 64, and Nero gets the blame, if you like, he then passes the blame on to the new group, this new sect called the Christians, and it's tragic what we hear of that. Nero was the one that used Christians as torches and lit up the city with the Christian martyrs. So he was not a friendly person, and he wasn't the worst persecutor of Christians of the Roman emperors, but he certainly was one of the first ones that really was doing it in earnest. And so if this is all correct, what Mark was doing was writing to a group of persecuted Christians in Rome, using the gospel as an encouragement to them as they were going through a really scary time and standing up for who Jesus was as the Lord in the face of a very powerful Roman emperor who was willing to do horrific things to torture Christians for their belief and their statement that was a direct claim on Caesar's throne. So the purpose of the Gospel of Mark was to record the eyewitness testimony of the first disciple, Peter, and was also written to encourage Italian Christians to remain faithful in the face of increasing persecution from the empire. Life was difficult, and this is another quote from, this is from a lesson on the Gospels on the Third Mill website. Life was difficult in many ways for the Christians in and near Rome during this period, and as we will see, Mark designed his gospel to minister to their circumstances. While there are many ways to describe Mark's purpose for writing, in this lesson we'll focus on the idea that Mark wrote his gospel to strengthen the persecuted Christians of Rome. Mark's gospel made it clear that whatever difficulties and temptations the Roman Christians faced as they suffered for Christ, they could be sure that Jesus had already faced them. He had been unjustly condemned in a Roman court. He had been beaten by Roman soldiers, and he had been crucified on a Roman cross. But through his suffering, Jesus had been victorious. And Mark wanted to assure his audience that if they followed Jesus faithfully, they would be conquerors too. Yes, they would suffer, but their suffering would be their path to glory, just as it had been for Jesus. Now, one last point I want to make about the structure of Mark's gospel, and then this is just kind of a neat thing. But if you turn with me to Acts chapter 10, verse 34, we actually find a sermon by the Apostle Peter. And it's probably a sermon in summary. And remember, the book of Acts was written by Luke. So this is Luke's recounting of a sermon that he may or may not have heard from the Apostle Peter. And this is Peter speaking at the household of Cornelius. I kind of have the feeling that Luke wasn't there to hear it firsthand, but he's recounting what he heard of the sermon and the general content of it. So let me just read this whole sermon to you. Peter opens his mouth and says, "Truly understand that God shows no partiality, but in every nation, anyone who fears him and does what is right is acceptable to him. As for the word that he sent to Israel, preaching good news of peace through Jesus Christ, he is Lord of all. You yourselves know what happened throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee after the baptism that John proclaimed, how God anointed Jesus of Nazareth with the Holy Spirit and with power. He went about doing good, healing all who were oppressed by the devil, for God was with him. And we are witnesses of all that he did, both in the country of the Jews and in Jerusalem. They put him to death by hanging him on a tree, but God raised him on the third day and made him to appear, not to all the people, but to us who had been chosen by God as witnesses, and who ate and drank with him after he rose from the dead. And he commanded us to preach to the people and to testify that he is the one appointed by God to be judge of the living and the dead. To him all the prophets bear witness that everyone who believes in him receives forgiveness of sins through his name." Now, what we have there in Acts chapter 10 is basically a summary of Peter's preaching. And what we've been saying is the Gospel of Mark is a longer form of Peter's preaching. And so what you can do is you actually can line up Acts chapter 10 and the points that are made in Acts chapter 10 and find the connecting points in the Gospel of Mark. And you see the general structure of the Gospel of Mark there lines up with the general sermon structure of Acts chapter 10. The telling the good news of peace through Jesus Christ, the way Gospel of Mark begins, the beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ. After the baptism that John preached, and then immediately goes into the Jesus being baptized. God anointed Jesus of Nazareth with the Holy Spirit. In Mark chapter 1, verse 10, Jesus is anointed by the Spirit, descending on him like a dove. And then it begins in Galilee, and then the whole of the Gospel of Mark starts with the Galilean ministry. He goes around doing good and healing all who are under the power of the devil. Jesus' ministry in that section focuses on healings and exorcisms. Jesus healed many who had various diseases, and he drove out many demons. We were witnesses of everything he did in Jerusalem, and that's the second half of the book. Jesus enters Jerusalem, chapters 11 through 14. They killed him, crucified him, God raised him, he's risen, he's not here. He was seen by witnesses, tell disciples and Peter, you will see him. And then he commanded us to preach to the people and testify, and then you have the commission. So it really does follow the pattern, the Gospel of Mark, the preaching of Peter in Acts 10. So for the purposes of our study, we're going to use the following outline. This is a five-point outline, but we're going to go into a lot more detail in the coming weeks, where we'll look at the announcement of the Messiah, and then the power of the Messiah. The turning point in the Gospel of Mark is the confession of Peter at Caesarea Philippi in Mark chapter 8, And then the gospel turns and focuses on Jerusalem and the movement towards the cross and the suffering Messiah, and then finally concludes with the dramatic resurrection narrative and the victory of the Messiah. I'll give you, this is a bonus Old Testament, New Testament material. I was asked a question at the Rollins College about the laws in the Old Testament and Deuteronomy specifically, but the issue of all these laws, if you don't understand the context in which the laws were given, the laws will not make any sense. The laws are given to people for basically three points. One, to teach them how to be in a relationship with God, to teach them how to be in a relationship with each other, and to teach them how to relate to the people that aren't part of the community. And so all the laws are written with relationships in mind. And the context of the giving of the laws is the great story of God's redemption and rescue of the people of Israel. So the five books of the Torah all are conveying a covenant with God and his people. And the covenant starts by introducing who the people in covenant are, the Israelites, descendants of Abraham, and Yahweh, Moses being their mediator. It then provides the context of that relationship. Why should we make Yahweh our king? Well, he's the one who redeemed us and delivered us from bondage, who provided for us in the wilderness and healed us of our infirmities, and gave us, through his mighty acts and power and generosity and grace, this incredible vision. He's the one that made us his treasured possession and bore us out of bondage on eagle's wings. We love him, and he loves us. So when you're talking to non-Christians out there and non-believers, and you just put law in front of them, well, they don't have any context of why that law, or a college student at Rollins, why that law is of any value or any worth to them. The law is always within the context of the relationship. It makes sense to learn how to relate to Yahweh in that kind of intimate, sacrificial kind of way, only because of what Yahweh had done for them. And the same thing goes true for the New Testament and what we're trying to accomplish in leading people to Jesus Christ. When you just say, well, you know, you can't have sex outside of marriage and you need to, you know, not drink and get drunk, that's all a college student hears, you know? They hear those two rules right there and they're done with the Christian faith. But if they can get the understanding of the context of the relationship, that, you know, God loves you and he wants to be in this relationship with you, and whatever you have done in your life, and I know as a student you're probably pretty ashamed of some things. Whatever those things are, he has paid the price for those in full on the cross, in order to deliver you and to heal you and to bring you out of bondage. You know, when you say that to a business person who's in bondage to the Pharaoh of his employer, and a lot of people in our culture are in bondage to the Pharaohs of their employers, and you say, God has rescued you from that bondage, and he's delivered you, and he wants to heal you from it. It's in that context that the ways of God and the rules of the relationship become very meaningful and important. You know, I want to live a holy life for God. And that's why I'm very careful about how much I drink. And I'm very careful about my sexual morality. That's why those things are important. But they don't make any sense outside of the context of the relationship. And unfortunately, we're living in a culture that doesn't know that relationship, doesn't have that history, doesn't have the understanding of the Gospels. In fact, we're starting to become a lot like Rome was when Mark was preaching the Gospel to Rome. We're becoming a lot like what Peter was giving to this pagan society in Rome. And part of the reason for the Gospel is to get across the story of a new Exodus and a new start, a new creation that comes with a resurrected life. And Mark leaves his story of the resurrection off real abrupt. We'll get to that at the end of it, but it's because the story is going to be written in the lives of the hearers who believe the message. And his gospel is very powerful, so I hope you'll come back as we get into the details of it next week. Okay? Have a good night. Mm-hmm.